I know we have our traditional problem of people drifting in late. And if we could shut the door in the rear, please. This is Gene Zana, the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. And to my right, Bernice.
Okay. Good morning. This is Bernice Candarian, president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. I want to welcome everyone here. Gene has gotten us a great program this morning, and I hope everybody finds it useful. Thank you.
So, thank you. We're really going to have a full pack morning, and that's the reason we really need to push this. And so if everyone has their seat, and I've been hearing for the last year and a half members wanting another workshop on paratransit eligibility certification process, how to go through the certification process, and how you should share with them the details of your functional limitations, and think of not only those that you might have related to your blindness, but if you have other problems, maybe mobility, so forth, problems with orientation, sense of direction, things that you should bring up so that should be considered. So while I was in Washington, D.C. last fall attending a National Steering Committee for Project Action, part of Easter Seals, I inquired if we could have them give us another workshop on transportation, which we had one, Bernice, what was it?
10 years ago.
Was that long ago?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, 10 years ago. And so we're fortunate this morning to have Christy McLaughlin, who is from Easter Seals Project Action. She is a training and technical assistance specialist for Project Action. Has extensive experience in the field of transportation, has also extensive knowledge in the area of the transportation provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Christy has worked in fixed route as well as paratransit services related to what we're going to be talking about, primarily paratransit certification. She has been the manager of the paratransit services for Bloomington, Illinois, and then was the general manager of the Niles Dial-a-Ride in Niles, Michigan. And it has done, held other positions and is as a consultant and on transportation and has developed a lot of curriculum for training. She has a bachelor's degree in philosophy and a master's of science in applied health sciences. Also, we're very fortunate this morning to have Ron Brooks with us. And he's not in his official capacity with the paratransit services in Phoenix, Arizona. But we asked him, since he was going to be here, if he could also come to this workshop and provide some input from the perspective of somebody who oversees the certification process and also having been on the other side himself going through such eligibility, to give his input. So they, Christy and Ron, will kind of working together on this. So let's give them a hand, and Christy will start and kind of give an overview of what's going to happen for the next 3 hours.
I have a mic.
You hold. You want to use this one?
You have to push.
I don't see a button. Is there a button? Hello?
No,
okay,
yeah,
very good. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you, Gene, for the great introduction. As he said, my background is in transportation. However, I have been with Project Action for, I think, 8 years as of last week. So that's pretty exciting. And I just want to see, by a show of hands, has everybody heard of Project Action? Just want to make sure. Okay. A couple people maybe haven't, but what we do at Project Action is we provide, training and technical assistance on accessible transportation. So, it could be, you know, multiple modes of transportation. It could be accessible for cross disability issues, and so we really try to cover the gamut of accessible transportation in the training and technical assistance that we provide. And so we're happy to be here today talking about a good bit of the issues that are being encountered across the country on accessible transportation. I do want to start by saying, first off, though, that what I'm able to do is to provide technical assistance on the ADA. What we're unable to do is to provide legal assistance. And so occasionally, depending on the questions that are asked, I may have to say, you know, unfortunately, I'm not a lawyer. You know, liability issues are difficult for us to speak to, things like that. But for the most part, I'll be able to provide some best practices and some assistance in interpreting what the ADA requires and as far as accessible transportation goes. Ron is here with me, and I want to thank him for that. I've asked him to add any comments or answer any questions that he feels comfortable doing so. And I will also let you guys know that I don't mind being interrupted. So if you would like to stop me and ask a question, we do have some microphones. I'll just ask that you wait for a microphone since the room is pretty large, and we'll be able to get those questions answered.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Christy. Just before somebody starts here, let's have Christy finish like a particular section of her presentation before start answering questions, because we really want to get through everything and we want to be certain your questions are answered. So when there's intervals that where you think it would fit for the questions and you could stop, do that, because otherwise I'm afraid you won't get through.
Okay, very good.
There's a great interest here.
Very good. There will be several intervals that we're able to stop after each mode. We'll definitely stop and ask for questions. So please feel free to ask questions. I have planned to a certain extent for the session to be interactive, and so I have some questions that I would like for you guys to answer as well, and maybe start some discussion. And we'll also have an exercise that we'll be doing based on in-person paratransit eligibility interviews. So that'll be interesting. For that, I might ask you guys to move up a little closer, but I think for now we're okay. So as I said, we're going to be talking about different modes of transportation. Just to give you a little bit of an outline of what we're going to talk about, I'm going to start with ADA complementary paratransit. As Gene said, you know, he has received a lot of questions on eligibility and that process, and so we wanted to focus on that today. Probably half of our session is going to be on paratransit. But we're also going to talk about fixed route and some of the ADA regulations and best practices with regard to providing that service. I also want to go over some rural transportation issues. So that would be possibly inner-city commuter buses, which I'll explain in a little bit later, as well as demand response or deviated fixed route, which, again, I'll explain when we get there. I also have some information prepared on taxi cabs and motor coach. Now, it probably sounds like this is a lot to cover, and it is. And so it's possible that we may not get through everything, but we're going to do our best to get through as much of it as we possibly can. But like I said, we wanted to focus on paratransit, so we're going to start with that and make sure we get through as much as we can. So, again, thank you for having me. We'll have a question session after each section. So let's get started. All right, so I want to talk about first ADA complimentary paratransit. This is a service that is required to be provided and required by the ADA to be provided by any organization that provides a fixed route service. Is everybody familiar with fixed route if I use those words? Okay, well, I see somebody shaking no. So fixed route is a bus service that goes along a fixed route. It's generally provided by the large buses, but it can be provided by smaller ones. They have timetables. There are certain schedule that they need to keep to. Generally, there are bus stops for this type of service. So any agency that provides a fixed service like that must also then provide a complimentary service that is called ADA complimentary paratransit in the regulations. And the idea is that obviously fixed route is going to allow passengers a lot of flexibility. You know, they can just go to the bus stop, catch the bus. There's no scheduling. There's, all of those standard things that you would experience in riding a city bus. And paratransit is in place to be a safety net for those people with disabilities that, because of their disability, they can't ride the fixed route. And so, when you look at the pros and cons of both services, there are definitely some independence that you get by riding the fixed route that you don't get in paratransit for obvious reasons. And we'll talk about some of those things in a bit. But that's what the complementary means. It really is supposed to complement the fixed route. And when I say complement, there are different areas that that the service needs to complement the fixed route. One of those is the hours of service. So if a fixed route runs from 5 a.m. to 5 p.m., then the paratransit service needs to run in those same areas from 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. And I just sort of alluded to the next complement, but it's service area as well. And so the ADA does require that paratransit run at least within a 3/4 mile corridor of the fixed route. Agencies sometimes do provide service outside of that 3/4 mile area, but what is required as a minimum is a 3/4 mile corridor around the fixed route when it's running. And another thing that should be complementary is the length of the trip. And so, and I don't mean the length of a trip by the time it takes a person to get in their car and drive from their origin to destination. What should be complementary is the length of time it takes for a person to take the fixed route. And you would include in that time any time it would take them to wait at a bus stop or to make a transfer or whatever else is required of them to take the fixed route from their origin to destination. And a complimentary time to that is what would be acceptable for ADA complimentary paratransit. We actually had a couple of representatives from the Federal Transit Administration do a session for us, and this is a big question that we always get about trip length. And one of the examples they gave is if a fixed route trip takes, in general, 60 minutes, including wait time, then a complimentary paratransit trip may take 20 minutes more than that, 15 to 20 minutes, and that is what they would think is acceptable. Now, it's very relative, and you need to consider it case by case, but that is an example that they gave just to give you an idea. So next, I want to talk about who's eligible for paratransit, and I did mention that it's a service specifically for people with disabilities that, because of their disability, they cannot ride the fixed route. And so everything that has to do with determining the eligibility of a person that applies for this service, it's all around the idea of what functional skills and abilities that person has to ride the fixed route. And if that person has the functional ability to ride the fixed route, then they're not going to be eligible for paratransit. And if they don't, then they will. And there's obviously some gray area there and a lot in between, but that's the general idea. There are three categories of eligibility as listed in the ADA. The first one includes persons with disabilities that are unable to use accessible fixed route services. So, if the service is accessible by definition and by regulation, but the person, because of their disability, is still unable to use the service, either, an example of this may be that they are unable to navigate a system because they have a cognitive disability which prevents them from doing so, something like that. So if their disability is still preventing them from using a service that's accessible, then they're going to be eligible for paratransit. Category two is it includes persons that have the ability to use the accessible fixed route, but the fixed route is not accessible. So if the fixed route were accessible, they could use it, but it's not, and so therefore they need to be able to take paratransit. This is becoming less and less of an issue as time goes on. You know, when the ADA was passed, this was a big issue as there weren't very many buses with wheelchair lifts or ramps. And so it was an issue, you know, concerning especially people that used wheelchairs, but it's becoming less and less of an issue now. Category three is this includes persons with disabilities that are unable to travel to and from a bus station or a bus stop. And so this is all about path of travel and how accessible the path of travel is to the bus stop of their origin and from the bus stop to their destination. And so if those are inaccessible, then the person would be eligible for fixed route, or excuse me, for paratransit. And as you can imagine by hearing these categories, there's a lot of areas or a lot of trips that may be that a person may be able to take, whereas there are other trips where they wouldn't be able to take, and that's when we come to something called conditional eligibility, which we'll talk about in a minute. So there are types of eligibility, one I just mentioned, which is conditional, but first we'll talk about unconditional eligibility, and what this is a type of eligibility that the agency is saying that it is not reasonable for an individual to use the fixed route service for any of their trips under any condition. So they're unable to, because of their disability, use the fixed route at all. And what this means is that they're unconditionally eligible to use paratransit. They can use it for any trip that that the service is able to make within the service area and time. If a person is found conditionally eligible for paratransit, what this means is that for some trips, the person would be able to use the fixed route, and for some trips, they're not going to be. And this would be determined by conditions placed upon that person's eligibility. So, for example, if a person uses a wheelchair, then they're going to... Yes?
Could you use examples pertaining to blindness because of the...
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. I have my standard examples, but absolutely, we want to use something that's very relevant. So for a person that is blind, a condition that may be put on to their eligibility is whether or not they're familiar with the location that their destination. You know, do they have the ability to navigate from the bus stop of their destination to where they're going? And another could be that there might be a very busy bus station, you know, and if a person has low vision or is blind, are they able to navigate that busy bus station to make a transfer that may be required to ride the fixed route versus riding paratransit? So those are some of the things that would be considered when thinking about whether a person is conditionally eligible or fully eligible. Another, yes, Ron.
Yeah.
Can we get Ron a microphone? This one won't reach you, I don't think. This one is as far as it will go.
No. There we go. All right. Good morning. So, good morning. I'm Ron Brooks, and I just wanted to kind of add some more to that, just in terms of blind folks and conditional eligibility. And I wanted to actually identify a couple that are definitely conditions that should be considered. And a couple that are, they're very real, but they are probably not conditions for eligibility, but maybe they're reasons to do something else. And the ones that are absolutely legitimate, and these are the ones we typically see, are going to be busy, complex intersections. And that's particularly true, I think, if you are in an area where there are no audible pedestrian signals. You know, there's a big difference between an intersection that, even a complex one, if it has audible pedestrian signals that give you the walk cycle, that's a lot different than even a complex intersection without them. So knowing your community, knowing the intersections that you would typically need to use, and knowing whether or not those are accessible intersections to you is very helpful in the eligibility process. Another one that we'll typically see are trips, as Christy talked about, that involve transfers, particularly multiple transfers or transfers to routes that you're not familiar with. Unfamiliar trips is one that pretty much in my organization, our staff is pretty much, they're going to automatically provide conditional eligibility based on new and unfamiliar trips to anybody who is blind and has no usable travel vision. Because, you know, even if you can learn it, you probably aren't going to know it when you never went there before, or if it's not a place that you go often. Another condition that we look at is if a person has a mobility device that occupies the use of one of their hands, shopping trips we're typically going to say that's an eligible trip just because it's pretty hard to carry stuff when you've got your hands occupied with a service animal or a cane. So those are kind of conditions that you might want to be thinking about as you think about your own eligibility. One thing that we get as a question from blind people is, what about drivers not calling the stops? And I want to tell you that I don't believe that's a legitimate eligibility condition, because frankly that there is an expectation of law that drivers announce stops. And if they are not announcing the stops, that doesn't, in my mind, confer eligibility. What it confers is a need to enforce the law and enforce the requirements that are in the law. And that might be something we can discuss and debate. But from my standpoint, I'd rather have the community focused on getting enforcement than on, basically saying that because the system's not in compliance, we should be eligible. And frankly, at some point that becomes a Title II eligibility issue, mm-hmm. As Christy talked about. Mm-hmm. But my first goal is to get our stops announced and to make sure that we're doing what we're supposed to legally before we start forcing people to use paratransit, which to me is somewhat of an inferior system.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Ron. And I do have some information specific to conditional eligibility for people with low vision or that are blind, and so we'll go through that in just a second. There are a couple of other things that there's actually a very useful guide that DREDIF has created on the ADA, and there's one specifically on eligibility that has some very good information specific to this topic. But anyway, so the next type of eligibility could be temporary. So, for example, this would include individuals that might have a temporary disability or that their functional abilities are expected to change in a shorter amount of time. And so it could be, any injury that is expected to improve after a while, and so they could gain temporary eligibility during the time that they're unable to use the fixed route. Some of the more common practices that are used to determine eligibility, and I will say this, the ADA does give transit agencies the ability to create their own eligibility process, which is why you may experience a different process in a different city if you move or if you're visiting, and we'll talk about visitor status in a bit, but if you're outside of that visitor status and you need to apply in a different city, there may be a completely different process that you have to go through, and that's because the agency is able to set their process, and of course we always advise them to set that process with the input from people with disabilities from their community, but you might experience several different things. You may just have to fill out a paper application, and for those that need an accessible version, that needs to be provided, whether that be Braille or assistance in filling it out or whatever the case may be, but that may be the sole way that an agency makes a determination on eligibility. They may also ask that that a professional provide some information. Now, keep in mind that a person's diagnosis is not something that would confer eligibility. So whatever questions they're asking this professional should be, I'm not going to say it's always, but it should be based on the person's functional ability and what they're able to do with regard to riding the fixed route. They may have an interview process that you're asked to go through. This could be an interview in person or an interview over the phone. We're going to have an exercise in a little bit based on interviews, so you get a little bit of a sort of hands-on experience with that. They possibly could also have a functional assessment, and a functional assessment is where they would have the applicant either go through a simulated bus ride in a building with the things that you might experience out riding the bus, or they may actually take you out onto a bus and see what abilities the applicant has with regard to riding the fixed route. That would be a functional physical assessment. They may also have a functional cognitive assessment for those people with cognitive disabilities. Project Action offers one called FACTS. There are others. There's not any specific functional assessment that's required. And then there may be some level of path of travel assessment as well. So, you know, how far can a person walk? How quickly can they get from one side of the street to the other? Project Action does have a guidebook on making eligibility determinations, and there are very specific suggestions on how quickly a person needs to be able to cross the street to be able to do it safely. And things like that. And so we actually just updated the resource, and I would suggest if it's something that you're interested in, it should be available soon. We're expecting to be able to have those available to the public within the next month or so. So feel free to get that updated version if it's something that interests you. But there are very specific suggestions in there about how, again, how long a person should take to be able to cross the street to be able to cross the street safely, and how far they should be able to walk in order to be able to take the fixed route unconditionally and things like that. One of my favorite people in the industry, her name is Karen Hesch, and she often does sessions for us. She works in Pittsburgh, and she's the paratransit manager there. And when she has presented sessions for us, she talks a lot about the master functional skills list. And she says that anybody that's making eligibility determinations needs to have a master functional skills list. And what this list is, it's a list of all of the skills it takes to ride fixed route. And so when you're determining eligibility for an applicant, you're going to go through this list functional ability by functional ability and determine whether or not this person has all of those and can ride the fixed route, or which ones the person does not have, in which case under those conditions they would be able to ride paratransit. And so we always suggest when people call with questions about eligibility that they have some sort of idea of what this master functional skills list would be. And this is going to be the basis for their consideration, for every consideration, every applicant that they get. It needs to include every transit task or personal ability that would be necessary to take the fixed route. It's very important that it's exhaustive. It includes all conditions that might be experienced. It needs to have physical functional abilities, cognitive functional abilities, sensory functional abilities. You need to consider every part of the trip to and from the bus, waiting for the bus, getting on the bus, riding the bus, getting off the bus. And it also needs to reflect the community and how accessible the community is, and especially when thinking paths of travel, which are going to be encountered when riding the bus. As far as specific conditions that might be that might confer eligibility, there are a few different types of conditions. One are personal conditions. You know, a person may have there are just functional abilities that person's not able to do, and so those are the conditions under which they can ride paratransit. There also might be transit system conditions. And so we talked about one of the types of or one of the categories of people that are eligible for paratransit being those that could ride an accessible system, but the system's not accessible. So you have to consider your transit system conditions when determining eligibility. Others are environmental and architectural conditions. These are going to be the things that, affect paths of travel or waiting at a bus stop, things like that. You know, you need to consider, can a person stand at a bus stop or wait at a bus stop for a certain amount of time? Is temperature or weather going to be a concern at all? And so all of those things need to be considered when you're thinking about conditions of eligibility. Conditional eligibility, as you can imagine, is the hardest to determine. And you have to be very, very specific and exhaustive in the list of conditions that you give to somebody if they are conditional eligibility. And so we could spend probably the entire 3 hours on conditional, but hopefully if you have any questions, we'll be able to get to those at the end of the paratransit session here. But when determining specific conditions, you really do need to have, we always suggest that the evaluator have a rational process to go through. You don't want to have a lot of interpretation going into the process. So the people that are making those decisions need to know what safely means, for example. So what does it mean to be able to safely cross the street? I've used that word several times here. But that's one of the things that the Project Action Guide gives them is a specific amount of time that a person should be able to cross the street to be able to do it safely. So we're giving them some of those guidelines. If they don't use our guide, they need to have their own. What does safely mean? What does dangerous mean? So on the other hand, what does that mean? What is a barrier? You know, we use the word barrier, architectural barrier, environmental barrier. What do you mean by that? And so when you're considering conditions in that way, you need to make sure that everybody that's making those determinations are on the same page. And as a person that's applying, it's very important that you know what those things mean as well, because when you're filling out an application or when you're at an interview or if you are doing a functional assessment, you know what questions to ask, you know, if they are using some of those terms, you know how best to answer them, and you can focus any response that you have based on what functional abilities, and you can just be on the same page with the evaluator in that way. And one thing that's very important for transit agencies, and we always suggest this to them, is it's so important that if you do have multiple people making determinations, one way to test if your system's working well is to see if both people that do the evaluation come up with the same result. So, it needs to be measurable. You need to independently get the same result if you have other people doing the determination. So that's what we always suggest. As far as conditions, sometimes we get questions on how many conditions are too many conditions. I'm not sure if you've experienced this, but if anybody has applied for service, you may get a response that says you have 30 conditions, and it can be very, very daunting when you're trying to figure out, exactly what rides you're eligible for on paratransit and what rides you would need to take fixed route for. But there isn't actually an absolute number. It needs to be exhaustive. And if that is 30, then unfortunately it's 30. And then we would always suggest that the agency take the time to make sure that the eligible passenger knows exactly what their conditions are, what it means, when they would be able to ride, and so on. And we've already talked about some of the conditions that you may experience. I did want to go through some specific issues related to those who are blind or have low vision. And like I said, the information that I'm going to talk about all comes from the ADA Paratransit Eligibility Topic Guide developed by the FTA and DREDF. And DREDF is the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. For anybody that may not have heard of that, but you can they're available on the internet for download, I've just Googled ADA topic guides, and it's usually the first thing that comes up for anybody that's interested. But there are some very specific issues and abilities and conditions that eligibility determination specialists need to consider for people that are blind or have low vision. And Ron has mentioned a few of these, but I'll mention them all again just to have them all in one little location here. So people that are traveling to unfamiliar locations, people that are blind or have low vision that are traveling to unfamiliar locations often have difficulty getting from the bus stop to their destination or through a crowded bus station or stop. Under those circumstances, then that person would be eligible for paratransit. So one of the things we often get asked, and I'm just going to throw this out there, but there is a service called Travel Training that does train people, or there's obviously orientation and mobility as well, that could provide that training to orient the person to their location, but that actually cannot be considered. When you're considering somebody's eligibility for paratransit, it needs to be considered with their current functional ability. And if that does not include navigation from a particular place to their destination, then that ride would be eligible for paratransit. The next thing, there needs to be some consideration on traveling where there's not a detectable path of travel or a safe detectable path of travel. If the trip would require a person to, for example, travel in the road for a certain amount of time, that's obviously not safe. If there's a path, but it's not really detectable, then that's not an option as well. So you really do need to consider the path of travel both to the bus stop and from the bus stop to the destination with regard to people with low vision or that are blind. Ron also mentioned crossing busy streets. This is a very big deal when thinking about eligibility for people that are blind or have low vision. There are intersections that allow constant right on red turns, which can cause an issue. People in cars, as you all know, are not always watching for people to be crossing the street. And if they think they can turn right on red, they don't usually stop. So, or at least a good portion of the time they don't. So considering that when making an eligibility determination is really important. Another thing to think about are loud locations. And I think Ron had mentioned this as well. If you are at a station where it's very loud and there's a lot of background noise, that would make it very difficult for a person that uses sound to orient them to navigate, obviously. And so that needs to be considered when determining eligibility as well. Couple other points. One is the person does need to be able to find the bus stop. So I have seen some pictures of bus stops that I just wonder how in the world they were ever labeled a bus stop. I've seen a picture where the bus stop sign is literally halfway down a hill on the other side of a guardrail, and nobody would ever be able to find it. It was insane. And so it's very important to consider whether or not the bus stop can be found, whether it's a detectable stop in the first place. And if they can't find the stop, or if there's not some type of identifying information as far as what routes go there, that excuse me, also needs to be considered when thinking about conditional eligibility for people that are blind. And then this is more specifically for people with low vision or people that have night blindness issues, but traveling after dark might also be an issue to consider based on the functional abilities of the applicant when determining eligibility. So I've heard of conditions that are specifically related to the time of day and how much light is available for a person to travel. There are some very specific eligibility requirements laid out eligibility determination requirements laid out in the ADA. And I'll go through those, and certainly if you have questions, we'll get to those as well. But I did mention, and this is always the case, that information that's available needs to be available in an accessible format upon request. Excuse me. And so, so if a person needs a large print version or something in audio CD or Braille, then the request can be made and it should be provided. Now, I will say that the agency is required to provide a format that is usable by the person requesting. So they may have something in Braille already available, but if you're not a person that reads Braille, then that's not a usable format for you. And so so they would then be required to provide something that you would be able to use. So it needs to be in a usable format, and it must at least be made available upon request. Transit agencies have the right to take up to, or they have, 21 days to complete an application that has been submitted. And there is a little, depending on the type of process that the agency uses. So, for example, if an agency uses an application only, then once that application is submitted, they have 21 days from that day to come up with a decision. And if they don't, then the applicant needs to be provided service unless and until the application is completed. But let's say, for example, the person or the agency uses a functional assessment, which we talked about. And the application is not considered complete until that functional assessment is completed. And so you may turn in, what they consider an application, but then the 21 days wouldn't start until the functional assessment was complete. Now, having said that, there have been some findings in ADA reviews where it takes a very long time in between the time a person turns in their application and the time the functional assessment is scheduled. And so that is considered, it can be considered unreasonable. So if you turn in your information to get service on January 1st and you don't have your functional assessment until March, then that's not reasonable. That's not acceptable. And the FTA has said so in some ADA reviews. And so in those cases, it's not a reasonable thing to make somebody wait until that functional assessment is complete to start the 21-day process of completing their determination. So in some cases, you have to think of it sort of on a case-by-case basis. But in general, if it's not a long time in between when the paperwork is turned in and when the functional assessment is, then the 21 days can be considered to start after that functional assessment. When the determination is made, the applicant needs to be notified either in writing or in accessible format so that they know what their eligibility is, whether or not they have conditions, what those conditions are, whether or not they're going to have a recertification after a certain number of years. Agencies are able to do that if they choose to but don't have to. And so all of that information should be in the determination letter or accessible format that was requested. Anyone that is either provided conditions on their eligibility or that is denied eligibility can appeal the decision. And so you can appeal the decision completely, and let's say the applicant was denied, they can say this is wrong, this is why it was wrong, there are some rights. Excuse me. There are some rights that the applicant has as far as what information they can provide to support their appeal. They can make an appeal in person. They can bring supporting people or documents or whatever the case may be. But also, people with conditional eligibility can either appeal their conditions as a whole or they can appeal certain conditions. So if they don't think that a particular condition is appropriate to their functional ability, they can appeal that particular condition. Applicants have at least 60 days to file an appeal. Agencies can give them longer, but the ADA requires that they have at least 60 days. the appeal needs to be considered as a separate function of the eligibility determination process. So, so any person that makes eligibility determinations should not be the same person that determines appeals. And this just ensures fairness across the board. And so, and it can be a person that determines appeal. It can be a board or a panel, excuse me, of people that determine the appeal. You may see a variety of ways in which agencies handle that. As I said, the appellants, thank you. No, thank you very much. need to be notified in writing or in accessible format, also of the appeal determination, which the transit agency has 30 days to determine. So if the agency is not able to determine the appeal within 30 days, then the person needs to be able to take paratransit unless and until that appeal is finalized. A couple more things that we'll talk about before we do take a quick break, and I can take some questions on eligibility. I did want to talk about personal care attendants. Paratransit, passengers are able to have a personal care attendant ride with them for free. The need for a personal care attendant is determined by the passenger, not necessarily the agency. And the agency, on the other hand, cannot require a personal care attendant to be riding with someone. So so they have the right to bring a personal care attendant, but it can't be required by the transit agency. Obviously, personal care attendants can be family or friends or a person that is hired to provide the service. On the other hand, companions may also ride. Now, this is different than a personal care attendant. It can be a friend, family member, whatever the case may be. The ADA does say that the agency must transport at least one companion, and additional companions can be transported as space is available. And so if there are companions riding with people on paratransit, the agency will likely ask how many. They may need to check space on the vehicle and see if that's something that would work out. And any companion can also be charged the same fare as the passenger as well. Oh, and they must, companions must also share the same origin and destination as the passenger. This is a question we do get sometimes. Especially when I was working in paratransit, we would get the question from passengers, you know, can you drop me off at my house and then drop my companion off at their house? Unfortunately, no. Actually, that's not true. They could if they wanted to, or if that was something that was able to be worked into their schedule. But paratransit schedules are often so tight that that's not possible. And so the ADA does say that the agency has the right to say that the companions must have the same origin and destination as the passenger. Next, I want to talk about visitors. So if a person is eligible for paratransit in their home city and they're traveling to a different city that also provides ADA complimentary paratransit, then they do have some reciprocal service that they're able to use. They do have a visitor status that they're able to tap into at that service, or excuse me, at that location. And so what the ADA says is that visitors are entitled to 21 days of service within a within a year. And so the important thing to note here is that it's not 21 calendar days, so it doesn't start on January 1st and end on January 21st. If you take a ride on January 1st and you take one on February 2nd and you take one on March 3rd, that's 3 days of service out of the 21. And so what this allows people to do is, if they visit family a few times a year, they're likely able to get the trips that they need to have and still fit in within that 21-day period and not actually have to go through a separate application process in this different city. And so that's very helpful, considering people that may be traveling for family members or things like that. Having said that, though, if they need more than 21 days of service, the agency does have the right to require that the person go through their eligibility process, whatever that process may be, application or interview or functional assessment. So But again, the important note there is that it's not 21 calendar days and they can be used separately. Some resources, which I've already talked about, but I'll mention again, I certainly hope that if you're interested in more on eligibility, that you'll check out our guidebook, which is called Determining ADA Paratransit Eligibility and Approach Guidance and Training Materials. It will be up on our website hopefully very, very soon for download, or also we can send out accessible formats. And also those topic guides that I mentioned, they're developed by the FTA and DREDF, and if you go online, you can find them for download just by Googling ADA topic guides. And so they have several on both accessible fixed route and paratransit, and they're very, very, very helpful. I think if it's all right, Jean, we can take questions on eligibility. I do have some information also on paratransit operations, which we'll go through, which includes things like scheduling and wait times and windows and things like that. But because eligibility in itself is such a big topic, I would like to stop and take questions that you have specifically on eligibility. And I will ask that you wait to get a microphone.
Raise your hand, keep it up if you wouldn't mind, and then so that the volunteer will come around to you and give you the mic.
The handhelds are, there's another one somewhere.
We're missing a mic?
Yeah, we're missing one.
Okay, why don't you use mine?
Oh, I think they may have found it. Yeah, they just found it.
Good. Okay.
Is this thing on?
Yes.
Okay. My question is, I'm what I call a hidden low vision. Most people don't see it. However, mm-hmm. I'm also developing an arthritic foot condition, which kind of flares up, you know, and I work a full-time job and everything. So how do we write it or determine it so that I can use this as needed rather than just because it's a non-apparent visual condition, but yet it does kind of flare up when I'm doing my full-time job and walking and traveling. What's the best way to remedy that for the application status?
What I would suggest is, depending on the process that you have to go through, like I mentioned, it could be an application, it could be an interview, it could be functional assessment, but focus your answers either to the interview questions or to the application questions on what functional abilities your disability affects for riding the fixed route. So so you said you have sort of a hidden low vision disability. You would focus your responses on how that affects your ability to ride the fixed route, and that's going to give them the most information that they can have on whether or not you can ride fixed route and when you can ride fixed route. So they'll be able to make an accurate determination. And like I said, you know, they're likely in your circumstance, even though I don't know the specifics, there are likely some circumstances where you can take fixed route and some where you cannot. And so they need as much information as possible about how your disability affects your ability to ride fixed route.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a magic button that, so I guess when they're done listening, he'll just hit that button and then it'll get quiet again. I just wanted to say, you know, hidden disabilities is a big challenge, and just a couple of things that I would say to you. First off, although the ADA doesn't base its, the whole point of ADA is your functional ability to use transit. However, in most cases, agencies are looking at a combination of your functional ability and any underlying diagnosis type information. And what they're going to look for is, does the diagnosis that they have, you know, does the health information that they have support what you are describing as your ability or lack of ability to use transit? And we're very clear, at least at my agency, and I oversee eligibility for a pretty large agency. We do about 400 assessments a month, and it's all in person with an application. And we're very clear that we don't require people to provide medical information or diagnosis information. However, if you have a medical diagnosis or a specific eye condition, if you have documentation from an ophthalmologist, you know, anything like that, that information is still helpful because a lot of the people who make assessments are trained to look at that kind of stuff. But I agree with Christy in that when you talk about your ability to use transit, focus on how your specific, and I would say for this group, probably eye-related condition impacts your ability to do the things that are required to take transit, whether it's walking to the bus stop in different kinds of light conditions, crossing streets, reading information, recognizing the bus landmarks, different things like that. You know, try to be very, very specific and very concrete. The other thing I would say is that even though all of us transit people, and you know, I'm lumping myself in because I am one of them, we all talk about conditional eligibility and trip by trip. In point of fact, most transit agencies are not enforcing their eligibility conditions. That doesn't mean they can't, and it doesn't mean they won't. But you might want to, before you get too worked up about what conditions you have, you might want to find out, are they even enforcing their conditions? Because in point of fact, once you're eligible at all, you're probably eligible as much as you need the service. And personally, I don't want to get worked up over something that isn't really an issue. So what I tell people, and we do conditions, I tell the passengers that the conditions are as much for them to understand when we think they should be using the bus as it is for us to actually try and enforce them, because my agency is not currently enforcing trip-by-trip eligibility. Pretty much anybody who's eligible can use it whenever they need it.
Well, the mic is getting to go ahead.
Okay, my name is Charlene Ornelas, and I'm wondering, because paratransit is reciprocal, I may know my area and function there very well, but if I go to visit somewhere on a vacation, I'm sunk. So is there any category or any way of considering a category for people to become eligible under the reciprocal that I could use it somewhere else? And the other part is, when I think of, or I tell people when they're asked the questions, can you say to yourself all of the time? If you can't say you can do it all of the time, then you would become conditionally compliant or qualified. That's what I say.
Sure. In the first part of your question, if the agency is doing what they're supposed to do, and we hope that they usually do, then a person's eligibility should consider all conditions. And so they should consider whether or not a person can navigate an unfamiliar area, even if that's not a standard trip that they take. So one of my least favorite questions, and I do understand why it's asked, but it's still one of my least favorite questions on a paratransit application is, where do you normally go? And you see it all, I see it all the time on all kinds of applications, and I kind of understand why they might ask that question, but what does it really tell them? Nothing. It really doesn't tell them much. What it gives them the ability to do is say, well, they can get to those three places on fixed route, and so therefore they don't need their eligibility for paratransit, which is absolutely not true. So if the agency is doing their job correctly and they're considering all conditions, then your eligibility should be applicable if you go anywhere else. If you are given conditions on your eligibility and the condition says you can take paratransit when you're in an unfamiliar area, that's a very vague general condition that you would never get, but I'm just using them that hypothetically, then when you go to your new city you would then be able to use it there as well. Now, what I will say is that when you go to another city, if you are conditionally eligible, you go to another city, they're probably not going to enforce those conditions. They're probably not going to take the time to figure out what your conditions are, figure out how they fit into the trip you're trying to take there. They're probably just going to give you the service. But like I said, if they did their job right in the first place, it wouldn't be an issue regardless. Can you remind me what your second question was?
Hello.
Oh. I have a short memory span.
I think you got him. Okay, my second part was, well, the first part was if in my area I can, I really don't need paratransit any of the time. But in case I travel, I need to be qualified for somewhere else.
Okay. Well, yeah. So I think I did. I think I did address it then. Okay. So even if you don't think you need paratransit in your home area, some people still apply so that it's there if they need it. If they do end up taking a trip somewhere they're not going. But if you haven't applied for paratransit in your hometown because you don't take it there and you go to another town, then they can at that point ask you to go through the eligibility process. So that may be something that's necessary if needed.
Christy, I'm sorry. I think possibly the other question, part of that is, let's say paratransit in your hometown has determined that you are not eligible
okay.
for paratransit, but you go to an unfamiliar area and you want to get paratransit as a visitor, what do you do?
I would say take a step back, and what I would consider is appealing the decision in my hometown because they probably have not done their job well enough. If there are conditions under which you cannot take the fixed route, then you should at least have conditional eligibility in your hometown. And if it's the case that somebody is blind or has low vision and cannot travel independently to a place that's not familiar to them, then they're going to have some sort of eligibility. And my guess is that the determination wasn't made appropriately. And so so maybe take a step back and consider appealing the initial determination. But if you're not eligible somewhere else and you haven't made that appeal, then the new city can ask you to go through the eligibility process.
Actually, I'd like to clarify because we do something very different than that, and I think I interpret the requirement because the requirement in the ADA says if somebody asserts that they are eligible, you still have to give visitor status, and our agency interprets that to mean that if you are if you believe you are paratransit eligible, and or if you are from an area that where you've either not become certified for paratransit or you're from an area where there is no paratransit, if you call Valley Metro in Phoenix, Arizona and say, I have a disability and I'm not currently eligible for paratransit because we don't have it, or I'm not eligible in our own system because I've not applied, we're going to grant you visitor status eligibility anyway, because it's our understanding that if you assert your eligibility as a visitor to our region, we have to confer temporary eligibility or visitor status eligibility. Now, if we're exceeding the law in that, that's, you know, clarify it, because actually I'm not sure, but I thought that's how we've interpreted the requirement. Now, we do go beyond and provide 30 days eligibility in our system, but we frankly do that just because it's easier. We think people think more in terms of calendar months, mm-hmm. or you know, 30-day periods as opposed to 21-day periods. It also solves a lot of problems with seasonals that come every year and, you know, who are really high maintenance. So we just try to make it a little bit easier.
Well, one of the things one thing I can do during the break here in a little bit is maybe try to get a little bit more clarification. But the ADA does say that either people that are ADA complementary paratransit eligible or people that claim to be ADA complementary paratransit eligible are eligible for visitor status. And one of the ways that we've always provided technical assistance on that is we tell agencies they can't require some sort of rider card or letter of eligibility acceptance. But I would be really interested to see, and it's not a question that we get often, but exactly what you know, some of those findings have been, Ron, on whether or not.
We're back to don't ask, don't tell.
Right.
Look at that.
Right, right. So.
Question. Al Gill, I have a question.
Sure.
If you travel different cities, I found it difficult to find out how to get the information because everybody, all these cities have different titles. Like in some places it's paratransit, in Santa Clara County it's outreach, in Fresno it's handy ride, and so on and so on. And even the people in that town don't always know how to
get you
to the place.
Paratransit is often kept secret sometimes. So, what I would suggest, you can always call us. You know, call Project Action. I have a colleague. His name is Ken. He is wonderful, and he helps lots of people find transit when they are traveling or even in their hometown if they're having trouble. So that's an option. Another thing that you may do, if there's a visitor center, they would likely have information on any type of transportation that's available.
Local ILC.
The local independent living center would also have some information likely on available transit options, but I certainly understand it's difficult to find
what
those
options
are. How about
the fixed route transit provider to ask them?
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully any transit agency that you contact would be willing to give you information on the other services available. It's not always going to be the case, but usually referrals are pretty easily made that way.
Oops, wait a minute. I have a second problem.
Sure.
It seems like different communities have little different things about how much you can carry. For example, in one community...
I'm going to ask you to hold that question just for a little bit because we are going to talk about the assistance the driver can provide in the next section.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hi, this is Debbie Cordero. I don't know if this question should be in this session, but one of you mentioned something about enforcing the law with some of these buses that don't announce the stops. Can I ask that question now?
We're actually going to talk very specifically about stop announcements, so we'll come to that in a little bit.
There are a series of phone numbers that a lot of people don't know about, and if I'd have known this would have come up, I could have brought a handout. But the series of phone numbers are 211, 311, 411, 511, 611, 711, 811, and 911. Some of us already know 411 and 911.
Sure.
There is one for transportation, is 511.
Mm-hmm.
And I've used it here, and I've used it in San Francisco. So if you have a cell phone, try 511 for transportation. And I'm not sure how it connects with paratransit.
511 is?
Yeah, it's a California.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
511 is California specific, is what Ron's telling
you. Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Okay. But it worked in San Francisco and it worked in Sacramento when I needed to find out how to get somewhere.
Great.
Yeah, California.
Worked in San Diego.
Great. Perfect. Perfect.
The question that I have is I'm Vivian Younger. And the question that I have is, let's just say someone is visually impaired, but they also have physical disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
How do they determine which one they're eligible under?
They should be eligible under both if both affect their ability to ride fixed route. So so the person making that determination should consider any functional ability that is affected with regard to riding fixed route by their disability. So so whether that be low vision or blindness or a physical disability or a cognitive disability or a combination of all of those. As a matter of fact, in my time in making those determinations, it is often the case that you have multiple disabilities to consider when you're thinking about the eligibility of an applicant, and every single one of them should be considered when making that determination. Other eligibility questions?
I have a
PS. Very good.
511 worked great.
Good.
And bus and whatever. I also want to add on the one that is often ignored is the 211 is a call for help. Mm-hmm. There's a series of 24-hour-a-day volunteers sitting at the phone, and I don't know every city, and you ask them, I need paratransit, I need something, I need food and clothing, I need a place to stay, my kids are sick. It's 211, and it's an all-around purpose one, and as I understand it, they have a checklist, and they look for what you need, and they give you that information, so it helps to have a cell phone number.
Great.
Very good. As you've probably been listening to radio, there's been the last 6 months quite a bit of advertisements, I guess, or informational thing about an un-24-hour sleep-wake disorder that many of us have, at least 70% of us that have it. And I've found, talking to some of the paratransit providers those who are responsible for the certification for eligibility, this is something they have not considered about the fatigue factor that a lot of us are having, and it's not something that you can predict. And this is sort of the invisible disabilities. I think the first gentleman was pointing out that his mobility problem it's not constant, and that's when you get the call taker that says, according to this, you can walk at the thing, and you try to explain, well, right now the sleep disorder is kicked in, and crossing intersections is very hazardous, and they challenge you on it and say, nope, we don't think so. Just Sacramento paratransit is starting to becoming really enforcing it, though certification is being done by fixed route, RT here. So I was just wondering, in general terms, how do you deal with that if you got a provider that is now going trip by trip, is questioning your eligibility to ride when you got something that is not constant affecting you?
There are certainly other conditions that affect people. And one of the things that we asked on our application when I did this was, do you have good and bad days? And what does a good day look like? And what does a bad day look like? And how does it affect your functional ability when you're having a bad day? And so those are definitely things that should be considered. And I would imagine that if you've had a series of days where you're not sleeping, then that could cause you to have a bad day, and your functional ability is going to be quite different than on a day when you're well rested. And so those things definitely need to be considered. The questions that are asked either in an interview or on an application need to be very specific as far as how the functional abilities change. So and I will say that this is something that's probably lacking in a lot of the eligibility determinations that are made nowadays. And that's just Christy's opinion. But, you know, in what I have seen and what I have experienced in my dealing with eligibility, is that is an issue that's very difficult to determine, and it's probably one that's not determined accurately enough. But I would, for the applicant, my suggestion would be to make sure and put how your functional ability is on a bad day on your application, and because those are the most limiting conditions that you're going to experience, and that's what the eligibility determination assessor needs to know. And if I were talking to a person making that determination, I would make sure to suggest that they have really good follow-up questions to ask if they're doing an interview or on an application based on the most limiting condition that the person's going to experience, because that's what needs to really be considered.
Just to add to that, a couple of things. First off, as an agency that does in-person assessment, and actually we're pretty rigorous in terms of our assessment, and we do have a pretty good questionnaire. One of the things that is really important is if you have and I would consider non-24, even though it's a significant occurrence within the blind community, it's not a blindness-specific disability, if you will. You need to call that out as a separate issue when you're doing your application or doing your interview or providing information to the agency. Talk about your blindness or visual impairment, but also talk about other conditions that limit your ability to use transit, and I would call non-24 out separately. and do a very good job of explaining it, because if a transit agency person or an eligibility assessor is looking at you as a blind person or as a visually impaired person, they may have very good training about how blindness or low vision affects your ability to travel. They may not have good information about how non-24 affects travel, because it's kind of a new concept within the industry. The other thing I would warn you about with good day, bad day, and I mean, I think you need to ask, you know, you definitely need to call it out, but recognize that some transit agencies, and they are allowed to do this, they are saying that if you are solely eligible based on a good day, bad day scenario, and it's not just a blindness thing. I mean, there's lots of disabilities mm-hmm. where you have good days and bad days. They can say, and there are lots of agencies that do say, and I think Access down in LA might be one of them, although if you can correct me if I'm wrong, and I know you will, there are agencies who will say, if that's your only condition, we're going to require that you book your travel on the day before or the day of, because you can't know if you're having a good day or bad day till you wake up that day.
Right.
I think the key thing that Christy said is the idea of most limiting factor. And we preach this all day long to our eligibility people. They have to look at the most limiting factor, because that's what determines kind of the worst case. But you've got to be clear when you're given information, you can't just talk about blindness. If you've got non-24 and if it affects your ability to cross streets safely or remember the route that you're supposed to take, you've got to talk about that as a specific disabling condition and not just about vision impairment.
Yes.
This is Debbie Cordero. Just really quick. You kind of touched on the person doing the evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
How current or how often do they go through a class or a certification on up-to-date diagnosis? Like the non-24, I just started seeing commercials this past month for the public, you know, on Channel 7, Channel 2, so on and so forth. I was just curious so that they're up to date on what's out there, just like the gentleman just mentioned.
This is the famous ADA requirement that people be trained to proficiency, and that's literally all it says. So there's no specific requirement that says that people making these determinations need to go through classes on different disabilities or on different abilities or on functions. Or there's even no requirement that they know how to ride the bus, which we would hope that they would. But so to specifically answer your question, it could vary. Agencies may have an annual requirement to go through some sort of training like that. They may not. The technical assistance we always provide is that the assessor really does need to know, one, the functions that are necessary to ride the bus, two, some baseline information about disability and what functional abilities you can anticipate a person to have based on that disability. Now, that's not all that you consider, but baseline information is very, very important. Try to keep up with that type of information. Now, if the process works the way that it should and the questions are asked appropriately, then an appropriate assessment should be able to be made with that information. So unfortunately, or, you know, I guess it depends on how you look at it, but there is no specific requirement for an annual type of training or anything like that.
I thought the question was about the applicant being recertified.
Oh, is it? Is it recertification?
It could be like either or.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
That's what my concern is. How up to date are these people?
Oh.
Are they updated quarterly, yearly?
No.
No.
I mean, I don't know.
No, unfortunately, no. So my suggestion then to either the applicant or the person who's recertifying is to focus everything on functional ability, because that's sort of the shared language that you're going to have with them, regardless of what they know about that particular disability and baseline information. Now, there is the appeals process. So if they do make an inaccurate determination, then during the appeals process, you have the right to provide information about the disability, to provide professional verification, letters, in person, whatever, you know, whatever you're able to do. So hopefully it doesn't get to that and there's an accurate determination, but you do have that as a fallback.
You can also reapply any time that your disability changes.
Yes.
Or you can reapply. Let's say that you're already eligible, but you have conditional eligibility and you decide that your disability has changed or worsened and your eligibility is no longer sufficient to meet your needs, you can also reapply. So that's your right as an as a person using the service to say, hey, I want to be reassessed because I think my disability has actually worsened, or I have new information that I think will help you better understand my eligibility. Most applicants are not. Most riders are not going to do that because they figure every time they go reapply, they run the risk of getting a worse decision. But honestly, I think in most cases, unless your agency is strictly enforcing eligibility, it's not in your advantage to reapply.
Right.
But if you've been denied and if you've exhausted your appeal, and I just had one this week where we denied a lady, she appealed. She lost her appeal, and I got to tell you, this is not a blind lead. This lady really probably, I think, deserved it, but she is now reapplying, and she's allowed to do that because, and I'm sure she'll bring six more reams of paper to prove why we got it wrong last time, but she has that right, and we will put her right back through the process.
Christy, Mitch Pomerantz, and you raised an issue some few minutes ago, and I've been mulling it over. As Ron knows, my wife and I have had an ongoing debate for some time. I am not using paratransit, and the discussion is whether I should apply or not. Well, you raised a question because I'm the retired ADA compliance officer for the city of Los Angeles, and I still do ADA consulting. And you raised the issue of not knowing necessarily the route or the obstacles involved in getting to and from something. In the kind of work I do, I don't necessarily know what the obstacles are going to be. I may be going to and have gone to places that I have never been before and probably will never go again. So are you saying, and Ron, are you saying that the issue of going to a new location, someplace that I've never been before, is a consideration? I'm not sure it is with access, but then I'm not sure really what access's criteria are sometimes. But is that a consideration that I might use should I apply?
I think that, you know, obviously people that are blind are going to have different levels of ability to travel independently, especially if you consider the gamut of low vision and blindness. But if, because of your disability, you would not be able to navigate independently in a place you've not been before, then that confers eligibility. I mean, that you should be eligible for that. So certainly, even if you don't use paratransit, and even if you're not planning to use paratransit, but you wanted to have it as a backup and you wanted to apply and have that in your back pocket in case you needed it, then that should be considered by the assessor, you know, whether or not your disability prevents you from traveling, you know, what was it? It's Category 3, whether or not you can get to and from the bus stop. You know, from your origin to the bus stop, from the bus stop to your destination. And if being in an unfamiliar place because of your disability you're unable to do that, then yes, you should be eligible for paratransit for that trip.
Debbie, don't tell Donna.
and upon that, I think we need to move on further, but that was an excellent question.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, guys. I will stick around for a little bit afterwards.
No, take an e-break. We're moving on.
Right. No. I just mean that if you still have eligibility questions, I'll stick around a little bit afterwards. So, but what I want to do is quickly go through some operational information on paratransit, and then we'll take maybe a 10-minute break and let everybody go to the restroom. No break?
They can go. No.
No break.
He's
sorry.
Afraid you won't come back.
I'm sorry.
I know.
That's rough.
Well, I'll try to keep it interesting. But okay, so let's talk a little bit about paratransit operations, things like scheduling and windows and negotiating pickup times and things like that. So at a minimum, paratransit agencies are required to allow you to schedule on a next day basis. And so you have to be able to schedule tomorrow for or today for a trip tomorrow, even if it's Sunday. So if you want a trip on Monday, they need to have a way for you to call on Sunday and or make a trip in some way on Sunday for a Monday trip. Having said that, the scheduler does have the right to negotiate your pickup time within an hour before and an hour after what you're requesting. Now, having said that, if you're requesting a trip to go to a doctor's appointment and if they want to give you an hour later than what you wanted and that would make you late for your doctor's appointment, then that's obviously not acceptable, and so that shouldn't be something that's negotiated. Negotiate's the big word here because they can't enforce it on you. They can't say absolutely you're going to take an hour later for the reason I just gave. It could be a doctor's appointment or something like that. But the passenger does have the expectation that they need to be willing to negotiate that pickup time so that every trip can be put in an efficient manner. And the thought is that if you are willing to negotiate your pickup time, you're likely going to you're hopefully going to get shorter trip times, a more efficient trip. They're going to be able to work your trip in better with the trips that are already existing. Providers are often able to provide subscription trips, and this is a type of trip that is given mainly for people that have a schedule for work or something that's very steady. So, for example, every Monday through Friday, they go to the same place at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they come home at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And so what would happen or what can happen is that you're given a subscription trip, which is just a standing trip, so you don't have to call in every so often and make your trips. And then you know exactly what your pickup time is going to be going to and coming from, and you don't have to continue making those trips. Agencies are limited if they are experiencing what's called capacity constraint, and what that means is that they're denying rides because they don't have the space for it. So if they are at the point where they're denying rides because of lack of space, then they can only have 50% of their trips be subscription trips or those standing trips. If they're not experiencing capacity constraints, they can have more. And so you may experience a time where you say, well, can I have a subscription trip? And they say, no, we're full. Well, that they do have a 50% limit if they're experiencing those types of capacity constraints. So that may be what that what they're talking about. What often happens in that case is that you get put on a list, and if they have an opening, then they'll at that time put you on as a subscription trip or as a rider with a subscription trip. As far as pickup information, you're going to be given a scheduled pickup time, and that will be, what time the system has created. It's usually a system. It's usually a scheduling software that's used, what time you'll be picked up. That is often different from your actual pickup time. As you all know, they may give you a pickup window. And so it could be, they say, we'll be there Somewhere in between 15 minutes before your scheduled pickup time and 15 minutes after your scheduled pickup time. And 15 is not an exact number. It may vary a little from place to place. But they could give you that pickup window. And the expectation is that the passenger would be ready during that pickup window. When the van gets there or the bus gets there, some agencies give a time that they will wait on a person. So the expectation generally is that the person is ready to go when the bus gets there, but a lot of agencies will give, you know, generally 5 minutes or so for a person to make it out to the vehicle and board the vehicle before they leave. If the person is not ready on time or within that 5 minutes that the bus waits, then the driver most often will leave, and that's considered a no-show unless there's been some sort of cancellation in the timely fashion that goes along with what the agency's policies are. And so, like I said, the pickup window could be 15 minutes before, 15 minutes after. It could be 20 minutes before, 10 minutes after. It's generally no more than 30 minutes. But during that pickup window, there's often another little span of time from when the bus gets there and the bus leaves. It's quite confusing, actually. After the bus leaves, they can be considered a no-show. But having said that, the ADA doesn't actually require that any wait time be provided. So it's possible that the bus could get there and leave because you're not there, although I don't hear of that happening much. There usually is some sort of wait time provided. No-shows, as you guys probably are aware, it is just when the person that has scheduled the ride is not available when the bus leaves and did not provide any type of cancellation or notification that they weren't riding. There's also something that's called a late cancellation, which could be that the person did not cancel their ride within the policy, within what the agency policy says they need to cancel their ride, and that would be a late cancellation. But it's actually not a no-show unless it literally is the bus is there and or the bus may be on the way. That can also be considered a no-show. Operators are required to provide assistance, and there was a question about baggage. So if I don't get to the answer of what your specific question was, just make sure and let me know. But operators are required to provide reasonable assistance in boarding, riding, and alighting, which is to get off of the bus, any paratransit vehicle. And this could be assistance with pushing a wheelchair up a ramp. It could be assistance in paying a fare. It could be any assistance with accessibility equipment that may be needed. They also often have policies where drivers will help with some bags, whether it be grocery bags or store bags, things like that. The ADA does not require that type of assistance be provided, which is why you'll see different policies at different agencies. So some agencies may say the driver can help with up to 2 bags and they have to be less than 20 pounds. And some will say, well, they'll help with up to 4 bags, you know, whatever the case may be. So it's really important to know what the agency policy is prior to obviously doing any shopping so that you make sure that you can fit under that or whatever their maximum level of assistance is. But even if they don't, even if you're not asking for driver assistance, they may have a requirement for the number of maximum bags you can bring on the bus. I actually experienced this once where a lady wanted to do a monthly trip to the store and bring on 24 bags of groceries. And she wasn't asking for the driver's help, but as you can imagine, that takes up a ton of space. And we were running vans, so they're not very big. It takes up a ton of space. There were other passengers on the van, and so we had to, at that point, enforce a maximum number of bags rule. But that's generally why that's there. You know, there's the assistance for the driver requirements generally in place, one, because they don't want drivers to be expected to you know, transport things that are very heavy or assist with things that are very heavy and lifting and injuring themselves. And also it's a space consideration to make sure that there's enough for the other paying passengers on the vehicle. But again, you may experience different policies at different agencies, and that would be why. There is an expectation that the standard level of assistance on paratransit is going to be a bit higher just because of the nature of the service. You know, it's a service specifically for people with disabilities that can't ride the fixed route. And so therefore, there may be, some additional assistance that the operator is going to be needed to provide to ride the service. Some of the common practices or sort of reasonable assistance that passengers can expect and that are provided is some additional time to board the vehicle may be necessary to make sure that the person is seated before the bus moves, to make sure that any mobility devices that need to be either stowed away or secured are taken care of. Operators or drivers may offer assistance in paying fares. They may need to assist a passenger in finding a seat. They may assist with seat belts. And again, these are all paratransit things that may be considered a little bit of a higher level of assistance that would be provided than on the fixed route. We've already talked about the bags. They can certainly enforce a limit. They can also allow for more bags. It really is sort of up to the discretion of the agency, so finding out their policy is really important. The next thing as far as operations that I want to talk about is origin to destination. This is actually a pretty hot topic still nowadays in paratransit, and what does it mean exactly to provide origin to destination service? The ADA does specify that ADA complementary paratransit has to provide service from a person's origin to destination, considering that that's within service area and service times and things like that. The FTA did provide some guidance on origin to destination. As you guys may know, many paratransit agencies out there provide a service which is considered curb to curb. And what that means is that you are picked up at the curb of your origin, you're dropped off at the curb of your destination, and there may be some distance in between the curb and the door. And the FTA has provided some assistance that says that's fine if that's the general policy of the paratransit agency to provide curb-to-curb service. However, there are people that because of their disability, they need door-to-door service. And that would be the operator or the driver getting out of his seat and providing assistance either from the door to the bus or from the bus to the door of their destination. And so so the FTA has provided this this additional guidance that says that if a person, because of their disability, needs this extra level of service, being door-to-door versus curb-to-curb, then it should be provided by the transit agency as long as there aren't any legitimate safety issues that would be caused by providing that service. And so one example of an issue that might be considered a safety issue that would prevent a driver from doing this is if in order to help a person from the bus to their destination, the driver would have to lose sight of the vehicle. That would be considered not safe. You know, they don't want to leave other passengers, especially since this is a shared ride service, they don't want to leave other passengers on the bus while they lose sight of the bus to go and take somebody to the door of their destination. So that would be considered a legitimate safety concern, and the agency would not then be required to take the person to the door. But as long as there aren't those safety concerns, then the FTA has provided the guidance that door-to-door service should be provided if needed because of a person's disability. Let's see here. A little bit more about appeals, and then we'll take some questions on operations. We've talked about no-shows. We've talked about late cancellations. There are agencies that provide suspension of service based on no-shows. And they do this because there are, unfortunately, passengers that cancel a lot of trips at the last minute. And as you can imagine, this does affect the efficiency of service. It affects schedules and how on time the service is. So, for example, if a bus operator has three pickups in a row where they've waited the 5 minutes and the person was a no-show, that puts them 15 minutes behind on their schedule. Now, obviously, they're going to make up some time because they're not having to drop those people off, but that's just an example of how it might affect the time. And so in order to try to reduce the amount of no-shows that they experience, they often enforce suspension policies based on no-shows. One of the things that's being that's sort of in a transition, and I think a lot of agencies are taking this on. It used to be the case that almost every no-show policy I heard about was, if you miss three rides in 30 days, then we're going to suspend you for a week. And as you can imagine, missing three rides in 30 days for a person who only schedules three rides in 30 days is different than missing three rides in 30 days for a person that rides every single day back and forth to work. And so those are not that's not a fair comparison of whether or not a person is not following the policy correctly. And so the FTA is really suggesting through some sessions that I've heard them present on that agencies consider a percentage of trips missed. So so for example, you may say if a person no-shows 5% of their trips scheduled in 30 days, then we're going to pursue a suspension. And that then would be considered more fair because obviously the person who no-showed the three trips that they scheduled during the month is missing 100% of their trips, whereas the person that only missed three out of the whole month of trips is much, much, much smaller percentage. And having said all of that, the agency should not be charging no-shows to passengers when the no-show was beyond the passenger's control. So that's a very important thing to consider. You know, sometimes passengers are charged with no-shows, but missing the trip was completely out of their control. And you may at that point as a passenger have to appeal that decision and say why that missed trip was out of your control. And then that should be erased as a no-show and should not count toward any action that would be taken for suspension or something like that. So, for example, you know, if a person has a doctor's appointment and the doctor is running very, very late and they had a trip that they had actually scheduled plenty of time and should have been available to take their return trip, but because of something that was completely out of their control and they had missed their return trip, you know, that would be something that they could appeal, provide the information, and hopefully not be charged with that toward any type of action for suspension. Another thing to consider that might come up with suspension, there is something that we've received some guidance on recently that is considered a direct threat. This is the term that's been used by the FTA. And what this means is anybody that's providing any significant risk to the health or safety of others, and it can't be eliminated by any modification of policy, then that person may be considered for a suspension based on the threat that they are imposing on other riders or the driver. And, you know, example to this may be, you know, a person that is breaking the law, doing something illegal, somebody that becomes violent, somebody that, you know, I mean, it could be a number of things. You know, one example we had, when I was working paratransit, we had a young lady that really liked to ride in the front seat of the bus. It was a van. So, you know, the front seat, as you can imagine, they're bucket seats in the front of the van. And that was fine by us. We had absolutely no problem with that. But one day she reached over and grabbed the steering wheel. And thankfully, no one was injured, no damage to anything at all. You know, we considered a suspension based on that. We ended up working out a situation where she just never rode in the front again. And you know, if she got out of her seat, then the bus driver was instructed to stop and until she got back in her seat. And so so that was something that, that we had encountered. But it could really be any number of things that that fall under direct threat and can be considered for suspension by paratransit operators. As with other determinations that are made, any type of suspension also carries with it the right for the person to have due process and appeal the decision. They have 60 days to appeal to file an appeal for a suspension. The person that determines the appeal should be a separate function from the person who enforced the suspension to begin with. They have the right to be heard in person, as with any other of the appeals. Sanctions, unless there's a very serious threat, then sanctions should be stayed pending the appeal. So if it's a no-show suspension and a person is appealing the determination, they should be able to continue to ride until the appeal is determined. And then if the appeal is denied, then the suspension will occur. But if it's something that's very legitimately a safety issue, then a suspension can occur before the or while the appeal is being determined. It needs to be considered on a case-by-case basis in that case. That's all I have on operations. Do we have any questions before we move on to fixed route?
I have one.
Yes, we've got a microphone coming.
Thank you. I found that some cities or some states or whatever will not accept money. You have to have a coupon or a ticket and so on. And if you're not really fully aware of that, you can get into trouble like I did in the San Jose area. I had to send him a check afterwards, so it meant that I had to send him a $15 check instead of a $4 ride. So is there anything pertaining to that kind of situation?
There's nothing in the ADA that talks to that specifically other than operators being required on paratransit to assist in paying fare. That doesn't mean that they necessarily need to break their payment policy, if that makes sense. You know, I've actually never experienced that on paratransit. Have you, Ron? I've never known one not to take cash.
You know, there are lots that don't take cash. And actually, I think this is a very interesting question that has come up before. And I think it's an area that there actually should be some guidance, because this is a barrier. What I would say, as speaking now as an advocate who's informed, is that the ADA is very specific that if you are eligible for paratransit, you must be eligible to take service on a next day basis. Mm-hmm. And what I would suggest to you is that if you are in your own system, of course, you probably know the fare payment guidelines. You know that you maybe have to buy a pass or a tickets or a fare card or whatever they're using. But if you're in someone else's system, then when you establish your visitor eligibility, this is something that you need to do at the same time. Having said that, once you have visitor eligibility, you should be able to use the service on a next day basis. And I think that's something that from an advocacy perspective might be worth pursuing. And I remember in the old days when I used to live here, outreach was a classic example. I lived in the Bay Area and I didn't really use paratransit where I lived. I was in the East Bay. But I wanted to go over to Palo Alto, which meant taking BART to Fremont and then taking outreach. And I didn't have the little tickets that they sold. And it was a big problem. And I never got a satisfactory answer. I think it would be interesting for CCB to maybe try to figure out how that can and should work. And there may be something in there. I don't think there's any guidance at this point, and I think there should be guidance at this point. And you're in the Ninth Circuit, so you guys will get good guidance that you can share with the rest of the less fortunates in America.
You know, I actually don't think there is any guidance on this, but I am going to send a question to Ken and see if maybe he knows of something that we're not aware of. There may be something in an FTA audit or accessibility audit that has some information, but I don't know of anything.
Ken is so knowledgeable about this stuff that he needs bodyguards.
He does.
Yeah, I mean,
he's amazing.
Okay, this is Charlene, and I have a question. Under the paratransit, then, is it acceptable to refuse same-day requests? Because I may wake up in the morning and find that my conditional or the conditions that caused me not to use fixed route transit have triggered, and therefore I'm needing to get to somewhere. And
The ADA does give the right to the agency to require at least a one day, and by one day I don't mean 24 hours, but at least the day before. reservation. Having said that, and the reason for that is there's not always going to be space available. You know, a lot of times what happens is the agency will create what they call a manifest, which is the trips that the drivers make each day, and in a lot of cases they're full. And they only bring in the drivers that they need, or they may have every driver out there running a route. And so fitting in same-day trips can be very difficult and in some cases not possible. Now, having said that, there are agencies that will consider it, especially based on that good day, bad day thing. And some of them even do what's called will call, which is you go to the doctor at a specific time, but then you call when you're done and they fit your return trip in then. And that's an option that they have. It's not a requirement that they have to do that. But so yes, they do have the right to say you have to at least call us the day before. And my suggestion would be is if you think that there might be you know, some issue that you might have, some bad day thing coming up, that you go ahead and make the trip, and if you are able to cancel it, then you do that.
I have a question. This is Annette. Christy, what constitutes a subscription? How many times a month? Is that different system-wise, or is there guidance on that? And then I have follow-up.
Yeah, that varies by jurisdiction. Everybody defines a standing order or a subscription trip differently. And a lot of agencies don't have very well set guidelines. In our agency, a subscription trip is any trip from the same place to the same place on the same day or days of the week at the same time for at least a month. So basically, if you go to church on Sundays and you always go at 9 o'clock and you always come back at 11 o'clock, that's a subscription trip. Any trip that's recurring that you can repeat, and we say for at least a month just because that's, you know, it's not worth it to set up subscriptions for less than that. That is a subscription. So it's really, you know, ask your local transit agency or your local paratransit what their policy is. If you're able to get guidance, then that's what it is. And if not, then just think in terms of trips that recur.
Okay. So I know what the local agency is asking. I want to know if there is guidance, because there are several that are one day a month, and they won't take that as a subscription, but it's a necessary thing for several of the things. The other part of the follow-up is, I believe, Christy, that you said that for subscription trips, if there's always going to be a capacity restraint, that they can only do up to 50% subscription and allow others for call-in reservations. What if that is not adhered to all the time and you can never get in? The local paratransit has allowed to, every so many months, and it's a long time, say, well, we're going to start all over again, but we as passengers don't know when that's going to be, so we can't quickly call in and get to be. And Ron's example is a prime example. Sundays are very, very busy. And so to get a particular time, you can't change a time that you're, you know, where you have to be is. So my question is, what do you do with that?
Well, I think if the agency is experiencing capacity constraints and that is keeping them from getting above the 50% mark on their subscription trips, they need to deal with a capacity constraint. Mm-hmm. That's a big issue. Mm-hmm. And they shouldn't have a capacity constraint. That's right. You should be working first and foremost to eliminate that problem. And once that's eliminated, in my experience, it's beneficial to the agency to have subscription trips. It makes things easier. It requires less staff to make scheduling, less work on the manifest, less work on, the whole experience as far as the transit agency is concerned is a little easier with subscription trips. So
here's the rub. During the week, you know, that sometimes happens. On Sundays, the service in my small town of Clovis changes a lot. And what currently, there is no fixed route on Sundays. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to provide anything.
Right.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's that actually is the case in a lot of areas. Sunday is questionable as far as whether service is provided. And usually if it's not provided by fixed route, then they take that option and don't provide it by paratransit as well. But certainly if subscription trips if they are limited to that 50% maximum, then work on the capacity constraint. And if you can, if they have that issue and you can suggest that they call us, that's something that we are happy to work on them to try to, you know, figure out some ways in which that they're not going to experience that. But that's the big issue there in that case.
Actually, I think there's another big issue. And when the ADA first came into existence, the 50% subscription rule had a very, very good reason for existing. At that time, a lot of systems had small dial-a-ride paratransit type operations that they had in existence from, you know, way back into the 70s and beyond. And those systems were very small. And basically, under those old kind of what we in the industry called local option paratransit systems, basically they became services that the transit agency provided to the complainers so they wouldn't complain. They just basically took the same people and nobody could get in. And so what they wanted to do in paratransit was make sure that the kind of the haves didn't control all of the service. So they basically created the 50% rule to make sure that the people who weren't getting regular service could get some. Mm-hmm. But as Christy pointed out, nowadays, there is a zero denial policy within the ADA, and actually FTA has gotten very much more rigorous about enforcing it. Mm-hmm. You can't have denials. And so the 50% rule is moot. And I think a lot of agencies actually don't have capacity constraints, but they still have the old rule because they've always had it and they just don't know better. And right. So one of the things I think as an advocacy organization that CCB can do is to really say to your local transit authorities and your local paratransit providers, you're not denying trips on paratransit, so you don't need the 50% rule because it doesn't benefit anybody. Mm-mm. And I think that's just simple information and advocacy. It's not based in anything except his story and a lack of knowledge.
The question that I have is, a lot of times, like with access, we have somebody with a dog in the car, somebody else that can't bend their knee and sitting in a certain position, and maybe somebody else to say is a pretty large size, and it's hard to fit all of us with all of our different variabilities. If a person, say, cannot get in the car because of that problem, how do they address that, or is that even a consideration with the computers, you know, when they're setting up?
Sure. Now, I assume when you say car that they're providing paratransit with sedans.
Yes,
is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So absolutely, a lot of scheduling software programs will allow for some additional information to be included. Now, saying all this, that doesn't mean that your particular system has the ability to do this, but mm-hmm. I will say that it's out there, that they can add some modifying information to account for service animals being on the vehicle, people in wheelchairs that may take up a securement location, things like that. And certainly, even if that's not utilized by the agency, they can ask questions when they're scheduling that would help them to better schedule the rides. Now, having said that, a lot of times, if a trip is put in there, the software does most of the work. They combine people based on where their origin and where their destination and the times are, and it can be difficult for an agency to make those very specific considerations. So what I would suggest is possibly talk to the agency that you're working with and ask them, is there anything that I can tell you when I schedule to make that better, to make it so that it's not quite so crowded? You know, for example, if you're bringing a service animal, ask them, would it help if I told you when I scheduled my trip every single time that I'm bringing a service animal, even though that shouldn't be required? If it's helpful, you know, it may be something that you could do. But really, it's just based on the ability that they have to schedule the trips on their vehicles. If they use software, if their software has the ability to have that modifying information, and if they don't, then how much staff power do they have to try to work those situations out?
Now, my follow-up question is that, and this has happened to me, okay, we're getting into the car, sedan. There's not enough room for the dog, and the driver is suggesting that the dog be put in the back, you know.
In the trunk?
Yeah, in the cargo space. And I tell them that that's not acceptable.
No, absolutely not.
And they can't do that. And they can't do that.
They can't require that you be separated from your service animal. Right.
Okay, well, I'm asking
for general information
on that.
Yeah, okay, yeah. No, that's absolutely not acceptable.
You know, we run taxis in as our paratransit provider in Phoenix. So we're very, very similar to Access in some of those issues. She's being way too nice. Let me just, in Access, you guys use a software system called Adept. It does track equipment codes. It does track oversized equipment, service animals, and all the good stuff that people travel with.
Good.
This is That's a dispatch good. Issue I would be willing to put money on. I think the providers in LA are paid either by the trip or by the mile. And this comes down to dispatchers trying to load the trips up because that's how their company makes money. Mm-hmm. My suggestion to you is every time you get in a vehicle that's too crowded, file a complaint, and it will get their attention.
Ron, at the risk of triggering an ulcer for you as a paratransit provider, I have had a bee in my bonnet for years on an issue. Years ago, at least then, I was told that paratransit is defined as equivalent service to fixed route. There was a court decision some time back that upheld a provider's decision to only have day before service, not same day service. You had to call in the day before. I have always thought, and I have never heard a satisfactory explanation as to why, if in fact the service is supposed to be equivalent to fixed route service, that decision was upheld. And I guess my question is, and I know what trouble that would cause to paratransit providers in terms of scheduling. Access can't even properly schedule rides the day in advance. But are there any cases on the horizon that might change the current ruling?
Are you looking for same-day service?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I would put this in the same category as why is it if it's comparable service, is paratransit allowed to cost twice as much? The fact of the matter is paratransit is designed to be comparable service, but there were certain legislative compromises made, and one of those is on day before scheduling. Another is on fares. There may be others, but those are the two that jump to mind. And that is built in. It's cooked explicitly into the legislation. And changing that is going to require a change to the legislation. Mm-hmm. This isn't interpretive guidance. This is explicit in the law.
Okay. So the court case, and I think it was up in New York. So that court case basically upheld and supported what is in fact in the legislative minutia, because I've never read
it's
specifically
very either. Very specific, okay. in the regulations, those two things.
Okay.
Yeah.
There are a few areas in paratransit that are a little gray, and origin to destination being one of them, and which is why we get guidance on that. And there have been court cases on origin to destination, and you know, yeah. those determinations obviously are helping us figure out exactly what's required. But as Ron said, those two specific issues are very, very clear in the ADA.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So we have 50 minutes left, I think, and several different modes to talk about. I don't think we're going to get to them all. I would, Gene, do you have a preference on which ones we talk about, or do we want to?
Let's do this. Let's just throw out those who are still here. Let's find out of those areas that you're prepared to talk about.
Great.
Seeing what the priorities are, and since we are transitioning, and it's been suggested to me to reconsider what I said. Do you feel you need a little break, including our presenters, and then tackling the next topic?
Can we have 5 minutes? Because I want to kind of
yes.
just confer about how we want to approach this.
Okay. Let's have a 5-minute break and regroup.
Come back, people, or else he'll
Please.
Never let you have another break.
I'll let go. We'll unlock the shackles, and you can move. Christy, you want to take over?
All right. So we do have several modes that we were prepared to talk on today, fixed route being one, taxi cabs, motor coach, inner-city bus. We could also talk inner-city rail. That'd be commuter service. We could talk about rural transportation in demand response or deviated fixed route. And I just want to see what is of most interest to you guys. What are you thinking?
Shout out.
Taxi cab, I heard. Commuter rail. Okay. Anyone else? Okay. Well, let's start with taxi cab. And see where we get, and then we'll take it from there. How does that sound? Okay. So let me get to the right place in my notes here so I don't leave anything out. And I know we also had a question about stops not being called, and I do want to get to that even if we don't talk about fixed routes, so don't let me forget that. There we go. Okay. So taxi cabs, it's very interesting in providing technical assistance on the ADA and taxi cabs, because it's just so different from from you know, fixed route or paratransit. So so certainly if you have a question or for something that I don't go over, just let me know. But I did make some notes here. We also, by the way, Project Action has a frequently asked questions on the ADA with regard to taxi cabs, and that's something that that you can download from our website or order in any format that might be helpful. And all of our resources, by the way, are free. I don't know if I've mentioned that before, but so we do have that resource available if it might be helpful as well. So some of the important things to know about the ADA and taxi cab companies. First off, taxi cab agencies are not required to purchase larger, accessible, and by accessible, I'm speaking wheelchair accessible vehicles. They can provide their service exclusively with sedans. And so that's a question that we often get. They can and are able to. As a matter of fact, Washington, D.C. just was in the accessible cab business, I think, 2 years ago. Before that, we had zero accessible taxis in Washington, D.C. So, and at the time, they only purchased 10. And you can probably imagine that 10 is not really sufficient for Washington, D.C. But anyway, so it's not a requirement by the ADA to purchase wheelchair accessible vehicles. They are required, however, to provide transportation to people with disabilities. They're required to offer assistance to passengers as it's requested. They are required in many of their policies and procedures to offer a service that's equivalent for people with disabilities as people without disabilities. So if they provide a reservation service to other customers, they have to provide that service as well for people with disabilities. They are not able to charge a customer with disabilities extra fees for any assistance that would be required because of their disability or with accessibility types of equipment. So, for example, a taxi agency, if they charge a dollar to stow a bag for a person without a disability, then that's the same fee that they can charge a person to stow their wheelchair, for example. They can't charge an extra fee because the wheelchair might be larger or heavier or whatever the case may be, but they are able to charge the same fee, but nothing extra. It has to be comparable or equivalent. And they are obviously not able to deny any service because of a person having a disability. They also cannot deny service because a person has a service animal. They are required to transport service animals. I know that this is an issue with some taxi cab operators in particular, either that they're afraid of service animals, they claim an allergy to service animals, they claim a religious issue being around, especially dogs, is what we've heard of. It is the requirement by law that they provide the service, and if you're specifically looking strictly at law, it should be part of their job description that they're able to provide this service. That's not always the case. So there may be some times, and I'm sure there are some times where unfortunately you have to deal with the situation by filing complaints versus having it the service provided in the correct way to begin with. But the law does state that the service animals need to be transported, and again, it should be part of the essential job duties based on the regulation. Ron is not prepared, I don't think, for this, but I'm going to ask if he wouldn't mind, since he has a lot more experience with this than I do, if he might give some tips and talk about filing a complaint and the steps that might happen when those situations are experienced. Is that okay?
Sure.
Great.
So first of all, and actually I'm going to ask you a question.
Sure.
In return. So we know that taxi cab companies are not required to provide accessible vehicles in their fleet. More and more of them are choosing to do so.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that they are not permitted to charge extra to a person with a disability.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to know is, are they allowed to charge extra for use of the wheelchair accessible vehicle if they provide it?
No.
Okay. This is an area that they routinely, regularly, and flagrantly violate. So if you have members who use wheelchairs, and if you need to do a fundraiser, start here. Because this is an issue that has not yet been, I don't believe, has really been fleshed out and understood by the industry. In the past, the old practice has been that companies will provide one or two accessible vehicles. They'll make them available. There's usually a surcharge, $10 or $20. And then they'll charge, you know, some kind of a meter. Maybe it's the same, maybe it's not. And, you know, pre-ADA and you know, they could do that. But that practice has continued for many of these companies. And I think it's going to take grassroots educational efforts supplemented with lawyers to get the practice to stop. And I say that because I work with cab companies. Our primary paratransit contractor is a cab company, and we have helped them, you know, improve their understanding in this area. So a couple of things with cabs that you need to know. The cabs are regulated at the local level, and they are the quality of service and how you deal with complaints is driven by how cabs are regulated. For example, in San Francisco, cabs are regulated by the SF Municipal Transportation Agency, which is also the paratransit, oversees the paratransit in San Francisco. As a result, the cabs in San Francisco tend to be better in terms of not doing non-discrimination. They're better at non-discrimination. They don't discriminate as often as maybe in some other places. In other communities, cabs are regulated by the local municipality. They might be regulated by a state regulatory commission. In Arizona, where I live, there is no state regulation of cabs, so they can do whatever they want. It's wild. It's the old Wild West. What I would suggest to you is that with cab companies, first off, know your rights. And if you know your rights, then you're halfway there. And again, your rights as a person with disability are to receive the service, to not be charged extra. You are permitted to travel with your service animal, and you may not be separated from your service animal. So if the driver has a Prius and it has a station wagon and there's room in the back, they cannot require you to put the dog in the back compartment. Now, they're not prohibited if you ask them to do so because you want to do that. That's up to you. But I personally prefer to keep my dog at my feet, and that's just how we do it. If you have an issue, typically, if it's a good cab company, the management of that company will be very open to your complaint, and they will pursue it. Now, that doesn't mean it won't happen 10 more times next month, but the way cab companies typically work, the drivers pay to drive the vehicle, and then they make their money from you with fares. So if you have a complaint with a driver denies your service animal, you call the cab company, that driver is probably going to be have their lease pulled, and they're probably going to be gone within the next day. The problem is, from the cab company's perspective, drivers are like water. They can just go get more. And so sometimes they don't invest in training the way they should. It tends to be a problem that recurs. What I would suggest to you, and I know I have a friend here in California, and her approach is she just, every time they do it, she sues them. And they pay her every time. And they just keep doing it. Because, again, for them, it's actually, they don't really try that hard with training. It's cheaper just to pay the occasional complaint. So again, file the complaints, file them, start with the company. Usually they'll be pretty receptive. If they're not receptive, you're going to want to find out who's the regulatory authority for that cab company in that municipality, and you're going to want to file a complaint. In some cities, you can then go up to the Human Rights Commission or some of the regulatory authority. So it's very much at the local level. And I think saying more would be wasteful. I think if you have questions, we can try to take them on.
Yes. That's all of the prepared remarks, so we can certainly take questions.
You pretty much answered my question in regards to these drivers that don't follow they're supposed to follow. But my question is, in regards to tracking, once they're let go, if they try to come back, are they somehow in the system so that they don't come back?
You mean individual drivers?
Individual cab drivers. It's only because I've witnessed some things happen.
Sure.
And, so.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
I just didn't know if there was a database.
No.
Not that I know of.
I'm going to partly answer your question, Debbie, and help some folks out here, I hope. In my old job with the city of L.A., I had dealings with what the city of Los Angeles has in so far as regulating the cab companies, a taxi cab commission and a taxi cab administrator. Now, unless they've budgeted out that position in the last 4.5 years, those of you with the city who live within the city of Los Angeles can file a complaint with the taxi cab administrator, and you can get that number through 311. Those of you in San Diego, San Jose, maybe even San Francisco, although Ron explained how that works, they may have similar entities. And I did a pretty good job, I think, of training our taxi administrator. We had a few drivers who are doing other things now besides driving taxi cabs for the city or within the city of Los Angeles. To answer kind of your question, Debbie, I've had enough evidence over the years, particularly when I was using a guide dog, and in previously when my ex-wife used a guide dog, that there is profiling that occurs.
Oh, yeah.
Within some cab companies,
sure.
where they know who's got the dog or who has a particular disability, and it's interesting to kind of do a sting operation, you know, have somebody call from another apartment in the same complex, and they'll say, you know, I don't have a guy, I'm just calling for a ride, and say, oh, we'll have a cab to you within 5 to 10 minutes. And then you call up, and they know you have a guide dog, and say, oh, there'll be a cab here within 15 minutes to a half hour. Yeah. So at least to that extent, I believe that there is some profiling that goes on.
Yes. Yeah, there absolutely might be. What I would tell you is I personally, when I call cabs, I never tell them that I have a dog. Never. And, you know, I get this question all the time from the drivers. We didn't know you had a dog. And I just, like,
I don't
say anything. I would not, generally speaking, if you have a guide dog, they have to take you. I would not advise them necessarily in advance. I like what Mitch just said. And actually, ACB has done some work in D.C. with this. They did a little sting operation enforced with some nice camera work. And they got some great pics of cab drivers blowing by people with service animals to pick up better dressed people down the street, and made some nice TV pictures with that. So,
with all due respect, yeah. Christy, and I love Washington, D.C., but I've taken cabs there, and I've experienced being when I was with, for example, when Eric Bridges and I were working together doing some advocacy. I think we were going over to the Department of Justice, as a matter of fact. And Eric uses a guide dog, and we were passed up.
Oh, I have no loyalty to DC Taxi. Don't worry.
Oh, good.
what I will say is my I don't think my boss would mind me telling this story, but and some of you may know her. Her name is Donna Smith. She is blind, and she has on occasion asked me to go down and hail her taxi because they will not stop for her, and so I don't feel the loyalty to DC Taxi. Don't worry. They could use some improvement.
I spent many a night standing out on K Street.
Yep. That's where our office is on K Street. So.
Yeah.
Other questions?
Yes, this is Donna Sanchez. I had to leave for a few minutes, so I don't know if this is appropriate. But is this are you talking about cabs under the paratransit? Or can I ask a question about the cabs under
Please
the paratransit?
Please do. Yeah. Please do. Go ahead.
I am affiliated with San Jose because that's where I live, but I also am affiliated with San Francisco because I go there to the eye doctor. San Francisco works differently than San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
I go to the train station. I take the train there, and I get off the train, and I stand in a certain spot in the first cab you take. Now, the last couple of times I've gone, I've had the cab drivers refuse to take the paratransit card. They tell me they're not supposed to do that, but it's happened to me 3 times now.
Yep.
So I have to get out of the cab, or they won't let me in the cab and go to the next cab.
In San Francisco, are you're traveling as paratransit in San Francisco? So you're traveling with paratransit. You're traveling with a paratransit debit card.
Yes.
Okay. So in that case, what you want to do is you want to contact the paratransit broker and file that as a complaint. They actually subcontract with the taxis in San Francisco for paratransit, and they will be responsible. And I know the people because I used to work with them. They're pretty aggressive with the taxis there, and they will take you seriously.
The only thing is that when you can't see, you can't tell what cab it is.
No. I understand that, but if you can convince them that this is a recurring problem, they'll put someone out there to check it. I mean, they're pretty smart about that stuff. You just have to pursue it a little bit.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
I was surprised to hear you say that there is no law that says taxis need to have at least one accessible.
It's true.
Taxi. But
it is surprising, but it's true.
Another negotiation.
And then the local level, I understand that. I think Fresno had, because there's been a lot of advocacy, there are some guidelines. However, like Ron pointed out before, some of the things they get around, one of the things they do in Fresno is, but that one's not working, that one's not working, that one, you hear that all the time. And then there's one an owner of taxi company, singular, that is actually seven companies. And when they sue them and that company is down, it's the exact same drivers, exact same dispatchers coming out of the same yard. And he doesn't care. And so that's how they get around that. I know we're not talking about on-time service for fixed route, but I want to tell you a 20-second true story.
Okay.
I was on the council's in Fresno to advise the city for both fixed route, paratransit, and all that. And we looked at their statistics every month. And when we got to on-time service and we asked for reasons, why some of the drivers repeatedly did not meet their on-time requirements, one fixed route driver said, well, I'd make my on time if it weren't for the passengers I had to pick up.
Yeah, we in transit often think that. And I want to just say about taxis, and I think it's important for people to understand why taxis are the way they are. I mean, I personally don't advocate that you go out and sue people. I mean, in our industry in transit, I don't think that's the right approach. The thing that we have to understand is when we think about taxis, you got to understand how the money works, because how the money works determines why it works the way it works the way it does. And in a taxi environment, almost without exception, the companies make their money from the drivers who pay leases. The company doesn't get their money from you as a passenger. That's not how they get their money. They rent cars to drivers, and then the drivers go out and they get their money from you. So what that means, and there's good things about that. If you find a good driver, the good drivers in taxi work can actually make a lot of money because they get repeat business and they get repeat customers. The problem with the model is that the companies tend not to be very focused on the concerns that customers have. Because again, that's not how they make their money. So the way that you get cab companies to be interested as a company in your concern is by making your concern affect their finances. And unfortunately, the only way that you can do that, I believe, is to file complaints at the local level following the procedures that are in place. Now, I want to say also that there are good people in the cab industry. The company I used to work for, we had cab companies around the country, and they were they were some very good companies with very good people. Unfortunately, the cab industry is very diverse with regard to who's in it and why they're in it. And I think you just have to recognize that the money in the cab industry doesn't work like the money in the transit industry. So if you want to get the cab company's attention, you've got to deal with the cab company's finance. And that is by going to them and saying, your drivers are violating my rights, and if you don't deal with that fact, I'm going to deal with you. And unfortunately, I don't think there's any way other than that to get their attention.
Good morning. My name is Louis Herrera, and I have a question that's related towards both paratransit and cab companies. In Southern California, we have various cab providers that are contracted to take over the load, some of the load that cannot be covered by the paratransit provider. And the issue that I have, and it's, I don't know if there's a policy or a standard or a regulation that would force the cab companies who have agreed to subcontract with the service providers in the area, where if a ride is assigned to a cab company to take over, and we get into a situation where I've been in a vehicle where there's been three people already on there, a person with a guide dog, and then I have to find a way to get in there and keep the things safe. Are there any regulations set up by the Federal Transportation or any requirement that stipulates that the information that is already on the database is communicated to the overflow providers that are supposed to be taking over or picking me up or other people with a service animal and aren't... One of two things are happening. Either they don't care and they just want to make the fast buck, or they're not being informed. And my concern is that this is something that's not really being addressed because it is very, very common occurrence in the Southern California area.
They're probably within the what you may want to try to suggest to them. There's no regulation. But what you may want to suggest to them is that they establish a maximum capacity by vehicle type. And their software, and certainly in Los Angeles, the software will support this. So, for example, you can say that the maximum capacity in a sedan is three people. And when you're calculating that, a service animal takes one of those slots. That is doable. And you know, I think that that's one of those local issues that you have to kind of deal with on a case-by-case basis because different systems are different.
Well,
no regulation.
If I may interrupt you for a second, this is something that has been brought up. I'm also I'm a city commissioner for the city of Los Angeles. And what Mitch has told you, he's done a great job of trying to educate these people. And... the unfortunate thing is that they tell you exactly what you just said, and they claim that their policy is that a service animal is treated like another passenger. So what they tell us in public, what happens in the real world are two different things. And I think that this is something that I'm sure is not just in the Los Angeles area, and I'm pretty sure that it's happened to a lot of people. So what could be done other than kick Congress to pass a law that says, hey, you can't just toss people in there like animals? After all, you know, this is supposed to be something that you're agreed to take on to provide adequate, safe, comfortable service, and you're not. So the question is, what is the best way to get Washington, D.C. to send out a directive that says you can't be violating these people's safety?
Thank you. Thank you for your question. What I'll say is that a lot of times what happens is the public transit agency will contract with more than one taxi agency in many cases, and they will send out trips that they get, and taxi agencies can respond and say, I'll pick this one up, we'll put this one on our manifest, and the way that they get paid is by number of people that they take. So if they provide 10 trips, they get paid more than if they provide one, even if they're all 10 in the same car. And so to me, the responsibility to keep that type of thing from happening really falls on the public transit agency in monitoring their contract with these taxi operators. I would think that complaining to the taxi agency is not going to do you much good, but complaining to and bringing up the issue to the public transit agency is really the route to go if they're providing the trip on behalf of an ADA complimentary paratransit service, because they're paying the same to the taxi agency, no matter how many people they have in the vehicle at one time. And if they're monitoring their contract correctly, or in a way that is you know,
effective,
thank you, then that would not happen. So, so I don't see any change in regulation happening specific to how a contract has to be monitored in this way. But I think to get the you know, the answer that you're looking for, to get the solution that you're looking for, it would be complaining to the actual paratransit agency.
Did I address what you said?
Yeah, okay. I wanted to just add a couple of things to that. First off, the other thing that happens is where, as transit agencies, we are audited by the FTA. And one of the things that the FTA looks at within their audits, and they do different kinds of audits. There are ADA audits that look at our ADA compliance to include paratransit. There are triennial audits where they look at everything from policies and procedures to civil rights to everything, including contracting. You know, we have to answer to them for how we do our business, and certainly most of the findings that are changing the operational policies and procedures that we use for paratransit come from findings that come from these kinds of audits around the country.
Mm-hmm.
One last comment about taxis. This is turning into a taxi bash, and I don't want that to happen. And I'll tell you why I don't want it to happen, because taxi service does a lot for paratransit. It is mm-hmm. less expensive, which means more service can be provided. It is more flexible, which means that it's easier to adjust for morning and evening service spikes that used to cause lots of denials of service. Some taxi drivers, because they make their money on customer service, are very, very good. We use taxis in my agency for most of our service, and we have a very high level of service. With taxis, it's all about the company that you do business with, and it's all about the contract. So don't take away from this that taxi service is the problem. It's not that it's the problem. It's that it has to be managed, and you have to have the right people doing the work. And so, you know, when you hear all these issues, they're real issues, but it's not because the model's the problem. It's because it has to be managed closely. And in some cases, it may be because you have the wrong taxi people involved.
Absolutely. Other taxi questions? We only have about 10 minutes left. I did want to say a couple of words on inner city bus and rail. And for those of you that may not be completely familiar with that, what that means, it's generally a commuter service, inner city commuter bus, inner city commuter rail, that is provided. It's generally a limited stop service. And a lot of the ADA requirements that are associated with fixed route bus will apply for rail and inner city bus. A lot of them are the same. One very, very important thing to note, though, on commuter service like that, paratransit is not a requirement. And so you may experience that where you come upon a commuter service. So, for example, it may be providing service from the suburbs into the city in the morning, and they may provide service from the city going back into the suburbs in the afternoon, limited stops in between. For those types of services, be it rail or bus, paratransit is not required. And so that's a big thing that's often a little bit confusing. But a lot of the ADA requirements are the same as with fixed route. And I know that it's something that you guys experience a lot, and you have a lot of rail service here. But I did, since there's only 10 minutes left, just want to see what questions you have versus talking any specific issues. Also, being a the last 10 minutes. If there are other questions that you have, we can take those as well. I mean, fixed route or rural transportation, anything like that. So I'll just open it up and see what remaining loose ends we have.
Well, the mic is getting to one of the people out there in the audience. Let me ask you a question, and I think the answer is no, there is no regulation, but it was brought up about paratransit fares that can be double the regular fare on fixed route.
Yes.
And when it's not, and where paratransit goes outside of a service area, then they can set up the price they want.
Correct.
Our Sacramento paratransit charges $5 per ride here mm-hmm. for a single ride. When it's within the fixed route RT, Sacramento Regional Transit, that contracts them, they go to the airport. Sacramento Regional Transit doesn't go there, and they charge $50 per ride.
Woo.
It's disincentive. Yeah, you go with Super Shuttle or the taxi cab company, which are required. The commission here requires so many taxis to serve there that they must have wheelchair accessible taxis. But I just wanted to find out, is there anything there? Because the question comes up, and I tell people, no, there's no regulation that prohibits them from doing it. Even though they're gouging, but yeah.
That's correct. There's no regulation that prevents them from doing that. What that's sometimes called is premium paratransit service. And so any service that there's definitely a premium there. Any service that goes above and beyond what the requirement is, agencies are able to charge a premium for that. That's probably the highest I've ever heard. But
I'm guessing the reason that they actually do it is because the transit industry is very afraid of being accused of doing charter service.
Yes,
and
that's
so
true
my
too.
Guess is that what they're actually doing is trying to make a statement to the local business community here that we're not trying to steal your business. And in fact, we're going to charge so much that you guys are going to look cheap by comparison.
That's true. Several years ago, there was a big issue with some new charter regulations that came through, and a lot of transit agencies had to change the way that they did some of their business because of that. And there is a fear now that they'll be fined or in some way reprimanded for providing what some think may be charter service, even when it's really not. What other questions? We've got one.
I guess I'm a policy wonk. Ron, having dealt with ICE-T and T21, what's on the horizon? Are those regs up?
So
are they up for renewal anytime
they
soon?
They are. And in fact,
I was afraid of.
I was just multitasking, we call it. That's code for like not paying attention. I just got an alert across my phone that the Senate is about to announce a deal, which of course means that it's subject to House concurrence and the president's signature on a new transportation bill that would extend. And I didn't read the whole story because I'm not that bad. But it looks like they are about to announce a deal to extend the surface transportation bill, which is currently known as MAP 21, to go for another 2 years to get them through the 2016 election cycle, at which point then we're going to be right back to where we are today. That's very good news, though, because they didn't have one before. And transportation funding right now is tied to a very volatile funding source that is being drained as we speak. So this is very, very good news. I don't know the details, but that is what's on the horizon. Pay attention. And when the time comes, we're going to all need to start paying attention to transportation reauthorization. And that may get delayed for a couple of years, but the time, yeah, and that would be good news at this point. So,
I think we have time for one more question, maybe, if there is one. No one? All right. Well, thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. This was a really great session, great questions, which is always nice. I have some business cards up here if anybody wants one, and I'll stick around for a few minutes if anybody wants to ask any further questions.
Let's give Christy and Ron a big hand. Thank you very much for coming.